Salvation, individual and social. One of the defects of traditional religion is its individualism, and this defect belongs also to the morality associated with it. Traditionally, the religious life was, as it were, a duologue between the soul and God. To obey the will of God was virtue, and this was possible for the individual, quite regardless of the state of the community. Protestant sects developed the idea of finding salvation, but it was always present in Christian teaching. This individualism of the separate soul had its value at certain stages of history, but in the modern world we need rather a social than an individual conception of welfare. I want to consider in this section how this affects our conception of the good life. Christianity arose in the Roman Empire among populations wholly destitute of political power, whose national states had been destroyed and merged in a vast impersonal aggregate. During the first 3 centuries of the Christian era, the individuals who adopted Christianity could not alter the social or political institutions under which they lived, although they were profoundly convinced of their badness. In these circumstances, it was natural that they should adopt the belief that an individual may be perfect in an imperfect world, and that the good life has nothing to do with this world. What I mean may become plain by comparison with Plato's Republic. When Plato wanted to describe the good life, he described a whole community, not an individual. He did so in order to define justice, which is an essentially social conception. He was accustomed to citizenship of a republic, and political responsibility was something which he took for granted. With the loss of Greek freedom comes the rise of Stoicism, which is like Christianity and unlike Plato in having an individualistic conception of the good life. We, who belong to great democracies, should find a more appropriate morality in free Athens than in despotic imperial Rome. In India, where the political circumstances are very similar to those of Judea in the time of Christ, we find Gandhi preaching a very similar morality to Christ's and being punished for it by the Christianized successors of Pontius Pilate. But the more extreme Indian nationalists are not content with individual salvation, they want national salvation. In this they have taken on the outlook of the free democracies of the West. I want to suggest some respects in which this outlook, owing to Christian influences, is not yet sufficiently bold and self-conscious, but is still hampered by the belief in individual salvation. The good life, as we conceive it, demands a multitude of social conditions and cannot be realized without them. The good life, we said, is a life inspired by love and guided by knowledge. The knowledge required can only exist where governments or millionaires devote themselves to its discovery and diffusion. For example, the spread of cancer is alarming. What are we to do about it? At the moment, no one can answer the question for lack of knowledge, and the knowledge is not likely to emerge except through endowed research. Again, knowledge of science, history, literature, and art ought to be attainable by all who desire it. This requires elaborate arrangements on the part of public authorities, and is not to be achieved by means of religious conversion. Then there is foreign trade, without which half the inhabitants of Great Britain would starve. And if we were starving, very few of us would live the good life. It is needless to multiply examples. The important point is that in all that differentiates between a good life and a bad one, the world is a unity, and the man who pretends to live independently is a conscious or unconscious parasite. The idea of individual salvation with which the early Christians consoled themselves for their political subjection becomes impossible as soon as we escape from a very narrow conception of the good life. In the Orthodox Christian conception, the good life is the virtuous life, and virtue consists in obedience to the will of God. And the will of God is revealed to each individual through the voice of conscience. This whole conception is that of men subject to an alien despotism. The good life involves much besides virtue, intelligence, for instance. And conscience is a most fallacious guide, since it consists of vague reminiscences of precepts heard in early youth, so that it is never wiser than its possessor's nurse or mother. To live a good life, in the fullest sense, a man must have a good education, friends, love, children, if he desires them, a sufficient income to keep him from want and grave anxiety, good health, and work which is not uninteresting. All these things, in varying degrees, depend upon the community and are helped or hindered by political events. The good life must be lived in a good society and is not fully possible otherwise. This is the fundamental defect of the aristocratic ideal. Certain good things, such as art and science and friendship, can flourish very well in an aristocratic society. They existed in Greece on a basis of slavery. They exist among ourselves on a basis of exploitation. But love, in the form of sympathy or benevolence, cannot exist freely in an aristocratic society. The aristocrat has to persuade himself that the slave or proletarian or coloured man is of inferior clay, and that his sufferings do not matter. At the present moment, polished English gentlemen flog Africans so severely that they die after hours of unspeakable anguish. Even if these gentlemen are well-educated, artistic, and admirable conversationalists, I cannot admit that they are living the good life. Human nature imposes some limitation of sympathy, but not such a degree as that. In a democratically-minded society, only a maniac would behave in this way. The limitation of sympathy involved in the aristocratic ideal is its condemnation. Salvation is an aristocratic ideal because it is individualistic. For this reason also, the idea of personal salvation, however interpreted and expanded, cannot serve for the definition of the good life. Another characteristic of salvation is that it results from a catastrophic change, like the conversion of St. Paul. Shelley's poems afford an illustration of this conception applied to societies. The moment comes when everybody is converted, the anarchs fly, and the world's great age begins anew. It may be said that a poet is an unimportant person whose ideas are of no consequence, but I am persuaded that a large proportion of revolutionary leaders have had ideas extremely like Shelley's. They have thought that misery and cruelty and degradation were due to tyrants or priests or capitalists or Germans, and that if these sources of evil were overthrown, there would be a general change of heart, and we should all live happily ever after. Holding these beliefs, they have been willing to wage a war to end war. Comparatively fortunate were those who suffered defeat or death. Those who had the misfortune to emerge victorious were reduced to cynicism and despair by the failure of all their glowing hopes. The ultimate source of these hopes was the Christian doctrine of catastrophic conversion as the road to salvation. I do not wish to suggest that revolutions are never necessary, but I do wish to suggest that they are not shortcuts to the millennium. There is no shortcut to the good life, whether individual or social. To build up the good life, we must build up intelligence, self-control, and sympathy. This is a quantitative matter, a matter of gradual improvement, of early training, of educational experiment. Only impatience prompts the belief in the possibility of sudden improvement. The gradual improvement that is possible, and the methods by which it may be achieved, are a matter for future science. But something can be said now. Some part of what can be said I shall try to indicate in a final section.